Hello, friends, and welcome to the Healing Ground Movement. Now, for more content and bonus features, you can join us on Facebook and Instagram. And remember, all of our content is delivered freely, so please consider supporting the show by donating via the link on our website at healinggroundmovement.com or liking and reviewing the podcast on your favorite platform.
Enjoy today's episode.
Today's episode is brought to you by the incredible Rad Roller Mobility Tools, my absolute favorite tools for self-myofascial release for at-home treatment for all aches, pains, and mobility issues. Check out the link in our show notes below and use the special offer code HEALING20 to get a special 20% discount on your first order. Enjoy today's episode. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Healing Ground Movement podcast. I am your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, and we have another crowd-requested guest with us today. One of our listeners requested that we bring on Tom Seaman to talk about his journey in living with and healing from cervical dystonia. He is a certified professional life coach in the area of health and wellness, the author of two books, Diagnosis Dystonia, Navigating the Journey, and that came out in 2015, and then also Beyond Pain and Suffering, Adapting to Adversity and Life Challenges, which just recently published in 2021. He's a motivational speaker, chronic pain and dystonia awareness advocate, and health blogger. And despite my inability to say the word dystonia today, I know it's a symptom that Tom and I are going to be able to really empathize with each other on. It was one of my largest and most mysterious symptoms coming off of bacterial meningitis and all of the neurological sequelae that comes from there. And then Tom himself has a very specific dystonia in his neck, so cervical dystonia there. And he'll tell us a little bit more about what that is exactly. But Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm so excited to have you share your experience and your hard-earned successes and wisdoms with our listeners.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a joy to be here, and I will do my best to share as much as I possibly can.
And we'll keep a loose time commitment on it. Now,
okay. Yeah, I just want to say just one thing as in the beginning there with the intro, which I thought was great. Thank you very much. You mentioned that I've healed from dystonia, which actually is not the case. I have improved a tremendous amount. I've had it for a little over 20 years now. So it began in 2001. And back then it was so severe that I couldn't sit or stand for more than about 10 minutes. I was laying on the floor. It was the only place I could get comfortable. And I was kind of rolling around trying to find some sort of comfort level to try and minimize the brutal pain that I was experiencing. And so I've found a lot of ways over the years how to better manage those symptoms. And so it's really more about managing them every day. And I think that there is and the reason I'm bringing this up is because a lot of people will look at photographs of me and they'll see my neck turned and twisted. And if you see videos, severe muscle contractions that are causing head turning and pulling. Mm-hmm. And then they see photographs now or movements now that are nothing like that. And the assumption is that I've healed from it. And I don't want people to have the misunderstanding that I've found a cure or I am in remission or I've cured myself. I have to work every single day and be really dedicated to the things that I found over the years to be helpful, but also to be flexible with the changes to my body as life goes on. And in each day, how new stressors could cause new symptoms or an increase in symptoms and modifying the things that have helped me, because people ask me, what helps you most? And I don't know how to answer that question all the time because I've tried so many things over the years and what may have helped me 10 years ago or 20 years ago doesn't really help as much now. And the things I tried back then that didn't help might help me now. So it's always in flux, just like life. So it's ebbing and flowing constantly. So I just wanted to clarify that just real quick, just so there's, you know, a lot of people get that misunderstanding when they see me and they, you know, so what did you do? And well, I didn't,
thank you for acknowledging that and for catching me on that language choice, because you're absolutely right. And it sort of, it catches me a little bit in my own personal struggle around what is healing, what is healed, and what is managing. And I do have noticed more lately, as I had a re-injury about 6 months ago, that I am reacquainting myself with those terms. And I love the way you described and talked about the things that, you know, maybe didn't work 10 years ago, might work now, might not work yesterday, but works today. And having this moving target of living within our bodies and just knowing what they need. And I think looking at chronic injury, disease, discomfort, any of these categories like that, starts to sort of normalize the experience in a small way that we're all taking our bodies day by day about what it needs now, what it needs in these moments, and having this very specific thing that you're working for really colors that search. So thank you very much for bringing in that clarification and catching me on my word choice there.
And I did that because I'm actually kind of glad you said that, because mm-hmm. I wanted to actually mention that, because I probably would at some point during our conversation, because again, there is, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people, especially with any kind of a movement disorder, mm-hmm. if you see a still photograph of many people that live with cervical dystonia or any other form of dystonia, which mm-hmm. for listeners who don't know what that is, it's a neurological movement disorder that causes certain muscles in the body to involuntarily contract, spasm, tremor, et cetera, to throw them off balance and create abnormal postures. So as I was saying earlier, in my case, my head was turned to the right and leaning towards my right shoulder. So it was about a 45-degree turn and angled down. And I was locked in that position 24/7. Mm-hmm. Other people manifest differently, and it may affect different parts of their body. So that's called a focal dystonia. So it's focalized, it's localized, and it's focal to that particular area of my body. Some people may have focal dystonia in their hand, their foot, or some other body part. Mm-hmm. It might be multifocal dystonia, where it's a focal dystonia in other parts, multiple parts of the body. There's also generalized dystonia, where it impacts all or most of the body. And so it's very different, but you may see a still photograph of someone who looks totally fine, but it just could have been a really good picture. You got them where they were right. Okay. But if you see them move, all of a sudden the whole game changes. And I mm-hmm. can show, even in this video, where I'm, you know, I would show, you know, symptoms, and in my movements, and that actually brings me to another form of a focal dystonia called task dependent dystonia. And that's when someone is performing a certain task, and that's when they will experience the symptoms of dystonia. So the cramping, the contracting, the mm-hmm. the inability to move properly. So that may happen with someone who has, say, writer's cramp, which is a term that people are familiar with, where they have an inability to write. There is musician's mm-hmm. dystonia. So someone who plays the guitar may try, as they begin to play the guitar, they can be totally symptom-free. Once they pick up the guitar and start playing, mm-hmm. they are unable to move their muscles in the way that they want to. So it's almost like there's another being that takes over the body and controls it in a different way that you want to.
That's exactly what I had, actually. That my dystonia is a focal dystonia in my left shoulder, in my upper trap scapular area. And it's always sort of humming along in the background, always was. And when I played the harp, for me, the symptoms of the vibration of the soundboard on the right side of my body would drive into the neurology of my brain, and just that dystonia would ramp until I was in screaming 10 out of 10 pain by the time I was done playing. It's kind of heartbreaking.
It absolutely is. Mm-hmm. It's to be able to love something as much as one does, and then to mm-hmm. not be able to do it and that really is challenging for doctors to try and diagnose and treat, because, you know, there are people that who have different forms of dystonia that will play mm-hmm. music, whether it be just listening or actually an instrument, and their symptoms go away. Mm-hmm. So how do we decipher the brain in different people? So there's no two people that have the exact same symptoms or manifestation of the same symptoms mm-hmm. of the same condition. So the question, what works for you, is a very broad question, because what works for me may not work for you, even though we have the exact same diagnosis.
There's things like this that really bring in the bio and neurological individuality of all patients. And in a way, it's a frustrating blessing because it gives us that opportunity to really dive in and understand ourselves, our bodies, our everything that is working. But on the other hand, the cost of finding that personalized care is a lot of searching on the part of the patient and a lot of relentlessness in trying to find something that helps, especially a heavy thing to bear when you're talking, you began talking about your story at the beginning here, the amount of pain that you were in that basically, you know, had you on the floor just trying to find a way to exist. And so to come back from that, I mean, that takes a lot of resiliency.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. You have to be, you know, I often say you have to be patient to be a patient. It requires patience to be a patient. And it also requires a lot of perseverance and a lot of dedication and a lot of open-mindedness to anything and everything that might possibly help, because there are so many things. And I've heard some of the most seemingly outlandish things that have helped people that you know, normally wouldn't hear that have helped. And, you know, that's not something that you'd get from your doctor. It's just something someone happened to come across and tried, and boom, it helped them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to be very open-minded and to try and be as patient as possible, because it's not a quick fix. It's a journey, which is one of the reasons why I titled my first book. The title is Diagnosis Dystonia, Navigating the Journey, because it is a journey. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that provides a cure. It does not provides options for how to live as well as possible every single day, as well as possible, offering as many options as possible to try to see what works best for you. And then deal with what I think is neglected way too often is the emotional and psychological aspects of living with, like you were saying before, absolutely heartbreaking and devastating to be able to want to play the harp, and then all of a sudden you're unable to. Mm-hmm. How does one deal with that emotionally? And it's different for everybody. Absolutely. And so that's the main focus of probably most of my work with regard to the books I've written, articles I've written, talks that I do, whatever it might be, and all of the life coaching I do as well, is helping people, whether they have dystonia or not even a health condition, but how do they traverse the waters of the challenges and the adversities in their lives, which could be just difficulties with their relationships, with work, mm-hmm. with work-life balance, with anything that may pop up one day that's unexpected. You know, a storm comes through and all of a sudden there's a tree in your living room, which happened to me, which is why I mentioned that. You know, you wake up and, well, that's not what I was expecting. So how do I adapt and modify and get through this the best I possibly can?
And I'm glad that you brought up, even in talking about the consequences of it as well, is that you start to necessarily so blur the lines to these different categories of health. And it's something that's come up quite a bit recently on the podcast. And so I'm going to dive into it again today, that this whole idea that the physical health of the pain of the dystonia can be somehow separate or different from the emotional health of what you are missing out on, or the frustration of trying to deal with, or the exhaustion of it all, you know, that does a disservice to the patient, trying to find a way to get a way of living with and a whole body balance for whatever the stressor is, as you pointed out.
Absolutely. And I think that the way that we respond or react, which are two different things, the way that we respond or react to a certain stressor is going to increase or decrease the amount of suffering we experience emotionally, mm-hmm. but also increase or decrease the amount of physical symptoms that we may experience. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I'm really trying to work on with myself constantly, but other people as well, is how to not be reactive, but proactive, which is of course a very common saying that we all say, but how do we respond, which is more of a, okay, this happened, let me step back, let me think about this, let me assess the situation, versus a visceral reactive type, oh my God, this is horrible, I'm dying, you know, something, you know, and then we go through a cycle of, so we enter fight or flight, mm-hmm. which then creates more adrenaline, which creates more symptoms, which creates more fear, worry, anxiety. and wanting to run. And that's the thing that we want to do, is we want to run from what we don't like, what we dislike. We want to hide from what we want to. And I did that for a long time. In my early years with the dystonia, I was really blindsided by it. And I didn't have the tools at the time to learn, to know how to manage what I was going through emotionally or physically.
So can you take us back a little bit? But I want to really dive into the respond versus react. But before we kind of get into the lesson learned and takeaway, can you take us back a little bit to that personal experience and journey that you had with your diagnosis dystonia, and where you began teaching yourself and finding these answers to change what your symptoms were?
Sure, absolutely. So it was 2001, summer 2001, and I had been, well, I graduated college in 94, and I graduated with a degree in psychology and education. So my plan was to become an elementary school teacher. And I just, at the time, it just didn't seem to fit with what I wanted to do. I wasn't really happy with the way schools were being run. I just didn't want to dive into that. It just didn't feel right to me. And so I had an opportunity with my brother, who was a chiropractor like you. He started a chiropractic education company. So it was actually a nutrition and chiropractic education company for patients and doctors. And I was already in the education field. So I joined him, and I worked with him and some of our other partners for about 6 years. So I was an entrepreneur out of college for about 6 years. And I enjoyed it, but I really was missing working with people and kids. And so I wanted to go back to school for a master's degree in counseling, which I did in the fall of 2001. Now, several months prior to that, in the summer, I began to notice there was a very, very minor tightness in my neck that just wouldn't go away. I thought maybe I slept wrong. I thought maybe because I was transitioning from that work into going to be a student, I was traveling a lot back and forth, 4 or 5 hours, packing, unpacking, moving into my new apartment and everything. And the stress of all that, I figured that's probably just what it is. And when I'm settled, I'll get this all taken care of and checked out. And at that time, it was just very slight inability or tightness when I turned my head left. And I noticed a very slight head tilt to the right, just very, very, very minor. It then progressed a little bit to where, and this is kind of strange because this is different the way people, this is different than the way people would describe their dystonia. So my neck muscles in the very beginning felt very, very weak, in that it couldn't hold my, they couldn't hold my head up. So when I walked, my head would flop. When I put my right foot out, and then when I put my left foot, it came back to center. So it flopped back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Now, most people describe dystonia as contractions. And I don't like to use the word spasm, even though spasm is often used to describe it, because people will, you know, equate a spasm to, yeah, my back spasmed, I'm a little bit sore. Contractions are what dystonia is, where it's like this, it's almost like a, it's almost exactly like having a Charlie horse, that severe cramp in your leg. And that intensity, I wouldn't call that a spasm. That's a contraction. It's a muscle contraction that yanks your body in a certain direction. So that intense spasticity that comes with that is, I wasn't having that at first. I was just having kind of this like floppy neck. And so I thought I was out of shape. So I began to try and run a little bit, work out with some weights, get stronger. They didn't help at all. Eventually, those contractions got really bad. So in a matter of about 4 months, they got really bad to where I tried to stay in school and keep working, and I just couldn't handle it. So I had to drop out of school after the first semester. And that's when I was in too much pain, and I was locked into position to the right with the neck pulling so hard and forcefully. It was almost like somebody had a rope tied around my head and was yanking me. And it just dropped me to my knees. The pain I had was, if you can think of a time when you've injured yourself, and it could just be as simple as banging your elbow on a door jam, walking through a door, that moment of injury, and you stub your toe or something, where it takes your breath away. So it's, oh, that pain right there. I was experiencing that onset of traumatic pain 24/7. It never went away. And that's why sitting or standing where my neck had to, which was pulling and yanking once to the one side, it was trying to stabilize my body. My body couldn't stabilize it. So I had to lay down to get some relief. And then I would try and touch myself in certain ways and using what are called sensory tricks. which is it's a phenomenon where you can actually touch certain parts of your body very lightly, or massage certain parts of your face or your head, and with cervical dystonia, that actually turns off some of the signals from the brain to tell the muscles to contract. And I was using sensory tricks the best I could as well. So I went from being functionally uncomfortable for the first semester to completely disabled, where my day consisted of, for the next 5 years, my day consisted of getting up to, I got out of bed. I wanted to make sure that was one goal every day was get out of bed. That was my one goal. And whatever happened thereafter was just icing. So get out of bed, have breakfast, lay on the floor. I only got up to go to the bathroom or get food again, which I brought back to the floor, and I laid on my side and I shoveled it into my mouth because it was too hard to sit up and eat. That was my day. Eventually it got to the point where I could not live on my own because I couldn't cook, couldn't clean, couldn't do anything. So I moved in with my parents, and my approach to any kind of a medical issue has always been more of a natural approach. Mm-hmm. So I did not want to go the medical route, which for dystonia, the most common treatment for it are Botox injections or botulinum neurotoxin. There's actually four different kinds. So Botox being the most well-known, but there's Xeomin and Dysport and Myoblock as well. So I didn't want to go that route at first. I also didn't want to go the medication route. Oral medications are also very commonly prescribed in the onset. Didn't want to do that at first. So I went and I actually found a natural recovery program in New Mexico called the ST Recovery Clinic, which utilizes specific exercising, stretching, massage, nutrition, and just daily living strategies and various changes to your lifestyle to try and retrain the faulty motor programming in the brain. So and I went that route.
Yeah. So where did you find this along the route of your, because for the next 5 years, so right. did you live that way for 5 years and then, you know, begin to find these solutions, or was working through all of these solutions and kind of starting here? Was that part of your 5-year journey, trying to find a solution?
Right. Well, so I'd self-diagnosed. So when I finally, after sitting there in tears at the computer back when we had dial up and it was taking forever and didn't have all the search engines we have now available to us or phones to look at as well. So after I did an exhaustive search and I came across initially spasmodic torticollis, another name for cervical dystonia. And I found that, and then I did some searching on that, and I came across, this is during, before I even moved in with my parents, so I was still still at the university where I was studying, but I was just living and existing in my apartment. So I found that, and I went to the clinic, and I got there just on sheer willpower and desperation. It was the most hellish trip I've ever experienced in my entire life. And I can think of it right now as if I've already been through it. It was like yesterday. It was so unbelievably memorable and painful. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I came back from that. I began doing that program. And I was getting minor improvement. And I knew it would help me if I stuck with it, but I was incredibly impatient. And then I found alcohol. And alcohol was a neurological inhibitor, and for me, was very powerful in helping to minimize my symptoms. And so I went from my treatment approach, which was this program I learned in New Mexico, to modifying it to drinking more and more and more. And I found that I just began to just drink a lot. So that was one, helping to control my symptoms. Two, it helped to control the misery and depression and suffering that I was going through. So for the next 5 years, alcohol became my treatment of choice. So I fell into this completely isolated lifestyle of drinking and eating a horrible diet and depression and loneliness. And I wouldn't say agoraphobia, but I never left the house unless I had to go get some more beer. That was it. So for the first year, I was really trying hard to utilize these protocols that were moderately helpful. And then I found alcohol and food to try and comfort the misery I was going through. I then gave Botox a shot. I didn't help over the years. I tried many times.
So in these kind of choice points that you bring up, I think you point to two really important and common experiences in dealing with severe chronic pain and severe chronic conditions, which is, as you said at the beginning, it requires patience to be a patient.
Yeah,
or perhaps we have to acquire the required patience. Right. But yeah, in the beginning, and particularly when you have put so much of your effort into finding the answer, into self-diagnosing, particularly in the era of dial-up, it's a common theme I have talking with my guests here on the podcast, because we are all just on this earth long enough not to have had Google at our fingertips while originally searching for our answers. It's worth reminding maybe our younger listeners. But that a lot of these chronic conditions are changed in inches and steps and this nuance of day to day, as you mentioned. And yet there is still this big outcry for symptom management. And one way or another, we're going to kind of beg for that and find that way to make life miserable. Ultimately, I think it does make life miserable, some of our choices, but make it livable to have the symptom management while going through the process of healing the disease. And where the two don't meet in expectation timeline for the patient can end up being really destructive or disheartening is kind of what I'm hearing your experience on your journey.
Yeah, that's how it was early on when I was really, really trying to become 100% cured. Mm-hmm. And when I stopped the lifestyle that I was referring to, I dedicated my life to being healthy. And so I had, in that time, I had gained 150 pounds. So here I was, a former almost professional athlete in three sports, former worked with a health education nutrition company. And I became this completely reliant person on alcohol and food, and I was severely obese, on the verge at 35 of a stroke or heart attack. I mention this because this is the severity of what I was going through that drove me to this. So when I reached the tipping point of, I am killing myself, not with dystonia. Dystonia doesn't kill you. It's mm-hmm. the lifestyle that I was living that was killing me slowly. When I finally reached the point of, I need to stop this right now, and I finally did, I dedicated myself to losing all the weight, really dedicating myself to that program that I mentioned before, and said to myself, I am going to get as healthy as I possibly can, and I'm going to find a way to live as well as I possibly can with whatever symptoms I have. And mm-hmm. I don't know what that's going to be, but I am going to be as patient as possible, be as diligent, be as dedicated, be as perseverant as possible to get to where I can be as functional as possible, and then figure out how to carve out a life for myself with those particular outcomes. And I didn't set because in the beginning I set a time frame for when I was going to get better. I got rid of the time frame, mm-hmm. except for the losing weight part. That was a fun experience where I lost that in like less than a year. And I was, every day I was excited to jump on the scale because that was fun to do that. So aside from that, I didn't measure my dystonia improvement with any kind of a time frame. I did for mm-hmm. losing weight, because that was something I was very ashamed about. And so I reached a point now, and I'm really glad you brought this up, because I still deal with some pretty serious symptoms that put me back on the floor sometimes, where I have severe spasms and contractions, and I get pain every day. And some days I'm relatively pain-free, and some days I'm really hurting, and it's just mm-hmm. enough to get through the most menial stuff. So I have, in a nutshell, I've come up with a thought whenever something happens is, how do I make the best of a difficult situation? Okay. I no longer can do a lot of the things I used to do before, and I'm okay with that. I've had to learn to come to terms with what my life is right now, with the hope that I can still find someone to help me get better. Mm-hmm. I can still find things within myself to get better. But all the while that's happening, how can I make my life meaningful and purposeful and help others along the way? And that's something that took me a while to get to. And mm-hmm. that's something that, so I've learned patience, even though I'm still very impatient, I've learned a lot of patience by living with this. So mm-hmm. I'm incredibly grateful in many ways for having gone through this and going through this every single day.
Well, and here now you also brought up bringing us back to a point you made earlier about changing that viewpoint of reacting, you know, and doing the symptom management through alcohol and food to responding to what's in front of you and how you are. I see this just lens pivot on the stories that you tell yourself and how you engage with the symptoms that are in front of you, you know, and then hearkening back to my misstep with saying healed is that looking for health versus a cure. All of these things are really, you know, the respond and looking for health and that patience. It really keeps us in the present moment of what can we control in front of us rather than a spin out of what ifs and getting overwhelmed with things outside of our control.
Yeah. And a lot of us try and white knuckle life and control the flow of life. Mm-hmm. rather than learning how to relax into the flow of life. There's an affirmation I heard from Louise Hay. It says, I relax into the flow of life and life flows through me with ease. Mm. You know, if we look at anything that's happening in our lives, we have some control. But a lot of it we don't have control over, but we get so worked up about it and try and stubbornly manipulate things that we can. And then that creates more pain and suffering. And mm-hmm. we don't allow. So there's this resistance we have within us to allow our bodies and our minds to learn to flow with what the body and mind wants to do naturally. And also with our surroundings and what's happening. And, you know, we can take so many, you know, I don't want to go there really, but we can talk so many things that are happening in the world right now mm-hmm. and how challenging these things are. But how much can we really control them? And the only control we have is how we respond or react to these different things that are happening. That's the important thing. And again, that's a very cliche, very commonly used thing, but how often do we actually apply it is the question.
Well,
a lot of people, go ahead.
I say you bring up such a good point because it's a conversation that I've had a lot with my patients over the last year, that a lot of the frustration and anger and fear and other symptoms that come up from it that manifest in their body aches and pains, fatigue and malaise, because of, you know, whatever topic and whatever side of it they're on, it's outside of their control and outside of their comfort. And it's a little bit, you know, what you've been alluding to here, which is, you know, symptoms like cervical dystonia. Yes, they're outside of your control. They're outside of your comfort, but there are still things within that respond versus react dichotomy that we can direct how we lean into or away from a perceived misery and increase in symptoms that we can create for ourselves. There's a baseline, but we can rise and make it worse if we really wanted to.
Yeah, absolutely. I have in the last 6 or 7 years developed a new condition that's called middle ear myoclonus, also called tonic tensor tympani syndrome. And that is an issue within one or more ears, that makes sense. One or both ears where there is this, well, for me, it's like a butterfly is in my ear fluttering. And mm-hmm. when that happens, I have hyperacusis, which is, you know, for people who know that word, that's a highly sensitive, you're highly sensitive to noise and to sound. So even a whisper can be painfully loud. So I need to go into complete isolation when that flares up. Along with that comes this dizziness, not so much a vertigo spinning, but dizziness. And that is probably more debilitating than any kind of pain that I live with, because when that happens, I just shut down. And I, when it first began to happen, I kind of like fought it and resisted and tried to plow through. But when it happens now, I just, my voice goes down, my movements slow down. Everything gets me to just relax and be peaceful. And what's here's the reason I bring it up. Well, for two reasons. One, it's because my initial response to it was really a reaction, like, this sucks, I hate this, this is horrible, I have to, this, oh my God, I'm this on top of everything else. And the more I do that, the more adrenaline's pumping through, and the worse it makes everything else. And so I realized I have to just go within and relax and just, you know, find what I can do to just get through this period of time, however long it lasts. The other reason I bring this up, I forgot. I didn't. It's right there. I'm trying to think what I was going to say. I'm sorry. I hate when that happens.
I have those moments too.
This is what I meant to say. So what happens is it's really ironic. So when this ear issue flares up, because I relax everything else in my life and I pull back and I just allow and I try and just go into quiet spaces and almost a meditative place without even being realized, without being mindful that I'm in a sort of meditative state, My pain lessens, my movements in my neck reduce, my range of motion improves. So this teaches me that, hey, I can go into this place anytime I want. I don't have to have this ear issue create this, force me to chill out and slow down. I can do this on my own, and I can work on breathing and visualization and relaxation and pulling away from whatever it is as a stressor for me. And I can feel better. So why don't I do that more often? So I can't be angry too much with this ear issue, even though it bothers me and I can't stand it. I can't be too angry with it because it's teaching me so much about the rest of my body. Mm-hmm. And how that responding and flowing with it helps me get through and not suffer as much as I would otherwise, which I was in the initial years that this happened and the initial years I did when I had these severe symptoms of dystonia.
Well, what you bring up here, I think, is such an amazingly nuanced but really important part about that choice to respond versus react, is that to respond has a bit of curiosity embedded in it. And within that curiosity, there is a place to learn. If the reaction is a constant tamper down and anger and make this go away piece, then there, to me, there is an abruptness and a dead end to that kind of experience. But this response, particularly in the way that you described it, you got to learn something and garner a new tool, put something else in that toolbox of, is this going to work today? Is this going to work? You know, should I do it every day? Is this the right dosing? Is all of these pieces? And very often, I think that is the gift of a chronicity, is that we slow down and we listen and we start to apply these responses outside of that acute moment. And that starts to gauge that search of what's going to help, what's not going to help, and what's going to come next.
That was beautifully said. Yeah. I'm not sure how to even add to that. That was so well done. I do want to mention also, this is what came to mind earlier when I was talking about that respond react situation. I have a client I've been working with for a while now, and I have seen her go from a baseline of pretty much symptom free, and she has dystonia and other health issues as well. I've seen her go from baseline of absolutely zero symptoms. Now within her, it's different. You know, that's just how the appearance is. But where she's happy, she's comfortable, she can move, she feels good, and she feels confident, and everything's great. And then all of a sudden, something will trigger her. It's an emotional, you know, response to something that she hasn't perhaps, you know, dealt with fully. And her symptoms will go to basically a 10 on her 1 to 10 scale. And then she will do various things to calm her mind or distract herself or leave the situation or whatever it might be. And then she's back down to her base level of, you know, very low symptoms, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 on her scale. I've seen this happen in front of me numerous times. It all happens within a half an hour. It's absolutely fascinating to see this. And what happens is, And it may be a thought that she has that isn't even initiated by somebody else. It may just be a thought that she has, or a memory, or something that, whatever it might be, or an existing topic that's a stressor for her that she hasn't yet fully dealt with. And it just, bam, it hits her out of nowhere. And she can barely move. She's in pain. And I said, well, what's wrong? She goes, it's just the pain. And I said, well, where's the pain coming from? It's the pain. I don't know. No one knows what's wrong. It's coming from. I don't know where it's the pain. The pain is the bad thing. But really it's not the pain that's causing mm-hmm. the problem. It's the problem that was existing that caused the pain. So her mind is, but she's gotten so much better with understanding how that works and how her reaction to things and how certain people and certain stressors and just various forms of toxicity can create that phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And that happens within all of us to varying degrees. And she is just, to me, always the best example of how intense it can be. Mm-hmm. So to see that happen in front of me is an amazing learning lesson for me and for her and for people in our lives that are helping her, you know, through this. But it just speaks so much to the power of the mind. Mm-hmm. And not to say that what we're experiencing is in our heads, because a lot of patients will hear that from doctors, from mm-hmm. other patients, from family, from loved ones, et cetera. It's all in your head. You're making it up. And that, I mean, what an awful way to shame people.
Oh,
and
goodness,
a person who's already feeling shame by not being able to live a fulfilling life and feel as if maybe what they're experiencing is their fault for, you know, already.
Yeah.
And then to tell them, well, it's all in your head.
Yeah. And it's you bring horrible. Up, it's a horrible, the gaslighting that can happen among chronic disorders and undiagnosable things. It's almost this shameful pitfall of a provider not having an answer and coming up empty-handed. And that's the reaction. But you bring up a good point, because it's something I'm trying to find the right way to say, and I often get a little cheeky with it, which is to take that very phrase and say, just because it's all in your head doesn't mean it's not real. The neurology, our brain, all of that center is encased inside of our skull. Yeah. And all the ways that we process pain and process sensory input, because when it comes down to it, by a pure chemical nature of it, pain is an interpretation of a sensory input, and it's all in your head. It's all happens inside your skull.
Yes.
But when we can turn that into a liberating key to the kingdom, instead of a shaming get over it, now we have this possibility of engaging with this interpretation of what sensory does to our body. My body perceived the vibration of a harp soundboard as pain in my left shoulder. Well, I'll be the first one to say that's absolutely ludicrous. Doesn't mean it's not real, doesn't mean that's not what my brain did, and doesn't mean there isn't a workaround that I had to get very clever about. I now play guitar.
The way you said that was actually, I'm so glad you actually found the guitar. That's wonderful.
Okay, well, it's the vibrations on the left side, so I'm good now.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
But the way you said that, though, with it actually, it is really in the head, mm-hmm. is so true. And it is, mm-hmm. you know, perception and everything. And actually, that brings me to something that was, I think, your most recent blog you put out was about proprioception.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with dystonia. Your proprioceptors are all screwed up.
Yep.
And working on that is, you know, when your proprioceptors, your proprioceptive system is not functioning properly,
mm-hmm.
it is a very stressful, very anxiety-inducing situation. And mm-hmm. that just further challenges us. And so our desire is to go and rest and do as little as possible and live in protection mode.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big mistake a lot of us can make, because our bodies have an amazing ability to remember what's quote unquote right and mm-hmm. what is proper moving, what is proper sensations of no pain. Because like you said, pain is an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Pain is an emotion. So if pain is an emotion, which has been proven and shown in scientific literature, if that's true, and we add an emotion on top of the pain, then we're adding fuel to the fire. And that's no different than there was a woman, I'm not sure what kind of doctor she was. She was, a psychiatrist, psychologist, something like that in Australia. Her name was Dr. Claire Weeks, wrote a book called Hope and Help for Your Nerves and mm-hmm. a video program called Pass Through Panic. And along the same lines, she would talk about people that experience these emotions, these experiences. And she would say fear and anxiety, they're all normal. The problem is when we add fear on top of the feelings that come with being fearful or anxious, that's when panic sets in. Yep. And so when you're dealing with a pain of any kind, which is akin to an emotion, and you add an emotion, especially one that is, we would deem as negative, a reactionary type of emotion, you're just going to feel worse and get worse. And so if you're living a life full of anger, resentment, bitterness, shame, you know, those different things, you're not going to get better. Mm-hmm. I hate to break it to people, but you're not going to get better. The body is physiologically not prepared for you to heal. So you may say, well, I'm trying meditation, I'm trying exercise, I'm trying this, I'm trying that, and I'm trying this minute, I'm trying that. Well, you've got to change your mindset about it. You got to let your body be more receptive to accepting what changes are taking place. Because when we are living in that state of mind I was mentioning, we are producing all of these stress chemicals and all these pro-inflammatory chemicals. Mm-hmm. And it's physiologically impossible to heal unless we learn how to get our emotions in check and learn to come to terms with life as it is right now. It doesn't mean it's going to be this way forever, mm-hmm. but come to terms the best you can. And I'm saying this as if it's easy, and it's not easy. It's hard as hell. It is so freaking hard to do this. Yep. And I mean, clearly, here's a guy that turned to drinking a lot of beer every day and eating all this mm-hmm. food and everything because I couldn't deal. I didn't have the tools and I didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And so I get it. I know how hard it is. So be kind to yourself, be gentle with yourself, be loving as possible with yourself. Realize you probably did absolutely nothing to cause what's experiencing, you know, it's going on. You're not, you know, try and deal with those emotions in order to get yourself into a place where your body is physiologically prepared to take on and improve whatever treatment protocols and route you decide to take. And it's irrelevant which ones you do.
Yeah.
But your body has to be in a state, you know, a lot of the people that I've worked with that utilize movement therapy for trying to create new muscle memory or train to modify faulty motor programming and create new motor programming. They try and utilize movement therapy to force it out of their body. And they utilize movement therapy when they're most symptomatic. That's not the time to do it. You need to get your body at most and your mind most mm-hmm. at ease so that you can allow yourself to, if you're, say you're stretching, if your body's already tensed up and you're trying to stretch, it's actually going to fight back and make it worse.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah. And what you're bringing up is just this universality of how we engage with what is, whether the what is a dystonia or, you know, political things outside the world or anxiety in our home or the tree that fell in your living room, which is not a what is that anybody wants. It needs to be done with this acceptance and response rather than a fighting of what is. Because as angry as you are, the tree is not going to cease to be in your living room. And your options for fixing that will be very limited until you move into a response zone. And when you bring up, you know, the movement therapies and things just being worse, you know, I think this is one of the superpowers of having a dystonia, of having a movement disorder, something that you've had to learn to live with, is that your smoke signal of get it together and accept what's in front of you is so much louder than most other people's. It's a bit of a force of a hand as far as I'm concerned. And so I did yoga was my movement therapy to help me recorrect a lot of my own history. And it's absolutely true. I come to the mat angry and upset and why me-ing, and I'm falling on my butt every other pose. Yeah. And I come with an acceptance of I'm going to show up and be the best version, the best embodiment that I can be today. And it's going to be, and it tends to be one of the best flows on my mat. Mm-hmm. And the comparison is really extreme with the movement disorder, but I think that a lot of people will see that in how they show up in their day if they pause to observe.
Yeah. And if you don't mind me asking, how did mm-hmm. you get from the point of showing up on the mat angry and falling on your butt to, you know, arriving as you are that day and accepting and flowing with it? And how did you get to that point?
Therapy. I took the long route. I went for suicidal depression was my take on that as I reached adolescence and realized that I was different than everybody else. It was no longer just that I was a clumsy kid who just was hearing impaired, but there were a lot of things that I had to do differently just to exist in the world. I got very angry, very why me? And I decided that I deserved to suffer more than anybody else. And so then I believe I did, because that's what I decided to do. And my parents found me a behavioral therapist. And so I began with mindfulness exercises, and I retrained my brain how to think. And every time I said something nasty and awful to myself about my deserving of anything other than misery, I cut it off, replaced it with something positive, and moved on. And I did that relentlessly for weeks on end, and then slowly changed my habit of thinking and changed my habit of belief.
That's awesome. So you really put in the work, you mm-hmm. put in the effort and the time. And I think what you said there really speaks to having to put in the work. Mm-hmm. You being everybody, you know, in order to attain anything, we have to put in the time and the effort and the work. Mm-hmm. You said mindfulness work. And I have, you know, encouraged people to do mindfulness meditation, or just, you know, and the term meditation, I think, is, you know, a lot of people conjure up, you know, sitting in lotus position on a pillow or whatever. And that for some people is a way to meditate, but I think we can be meditative in any situation in life. It's all about just where our head is in that space. So with regard to that, people will say, you know, after a week, well, I tried meditating, didn't work. Well, you know, we have to really give it time. And, mm-hmm. you know, and when it comes to a movement disorder and the movement therapy type things, like yoga or anything else, the body has a very strong motor program to contract when you're playing the harp, for example, or me with my neck, and when it's really flaring up. It's a strong motor program. And we need to really create, I often use the analogy of a golfer. So a golfer, you know, an amateur golfer, even a professional, goes out there and they hit a constant slice. So for a right-handed golfer, what slice would be, the ball is curving off to the right and either going out of bounds or just out of bounds to the right. And in order, so you've created a motor program in your brain for a slice. So your movements create a slice. So you have to modify your swing, your stance, your grip, your whatever it might be. And then you have to hit 1,000 more golf balls or more in order to get rid of the old motor program to replace it with the new one. Mm-hmm. And that takes time and patience. And so you have to ask yourself, how badly do I want this? Mm-hmm. How much do I believe in myself? How much do I believe in the ability to do what I need to do to get through, you know, this particular exercise routine, whatever it might be? How much do I want it? How badly do I want it? Mm-hmm. And it all really falls on us. Yeah. And we have to take responsibility for it. And again, it's a hell of a lot easier said than done, as you and I both know. We have to find ways to put in the work. Mm-hmm. And that goes for anything in life. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I wrote my second book. So my first book was more about dystonia issues, but my second book was adapting to all forms of adversity in life. And how do we learn to integrate our mind and our body differently with the challenges that you know, hit us every single day?
Absolutely.
And how do we flow with it? And how do we not live in this world of resistance of things we don't like?
Absolutely. Nice. And so up with this, how badly do you want this? Do you want it enough to work to make it as habitual as the thing you're trying to replace? Yeah. And that takes a lot more work than I think most of us realize at the onset. But, you know, in my experience, has been worth it time and time and time and time again, because life will continue to throw curveballs and slices at you.
Yeah.
But Tom, as you mentioned your books, I feel like it's a good time to mention and share with our listeners that we do have a copy of each of your books that you have so generously gifted. I believe you even signed them. So we have signed copies of this book that we will share with our listeners. So we're going to do another book giveaway We're going to pick two winners because we have Tom's first book and his second book. Please sign on to Instagram, find Healing Ground Movement. And you will find the giveaway post as we now typically do. But for this one, would love it if you tell us which book you want and why, what you are excited to learn or what you've been excited to learn from this podcast. And we'll pick a random winner from those likes, shares, and comments as well. So head on to Healing Ground Movement. That comes out the week the episode drops. And we've got two generous copies to share.
That's a cool idea. I like the way you're doing that. That's fun.
We have such incredible guests here on the podcast and are always happy to share your incredible knowledge and the hard work put into writing a book. I'm just finishing my first manuscript, and that is, again, how badly do you want this? That is not for the faint of heart. It goes.
Yeah.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for all of your experience and just candid vulnerability on what it takes to live and exist as you do and the wisdom that you share with your clients and now my listeners. I appreciate you.
Thank you very much. And I really enjoyed speaking with you. We spoke very briefly a bunch of months back, and I'm glad we had this time to talk to each other. And I really enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us today. I hope that there is some resiliency in a lesson of witnessing yourself in a response versus a reaction that you can take into your week and see if you see your world and see your stressors a little bit differently. Until then, we'll see you next week with another episode of Healing Ground Movement Podcast. Until then, be well. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard and got a little something out of it to help you on your journey to health. Please, if you're inclined, share this podcast with a friend so we can help more people lead healthier lives. Now remember, the information expressed in these interviews is for informational and not diagnostic or treatment purposes. However, I hope you find that having the right information and resources can go a long way to helping you on your healthcare journey. Ask the right questions and seek out professional help. And we'll see you next week for another episode of the Healing Ground Movement Podcast. Be well.